So hi all, welcome to lecture 7 on February 7. I always get nervous when things like that happen. Matching numbers, is that a bad sign or a good omen? I don't know. Lecture notes page 70. Something's going to go wrong for sure. 777. All right. So we're going to start off by hearing from Cecilia and Alyssa on the reasons to consider pi sigma epsilon, and to do that we're going to jump over to their slideshow, which is here, and I think to make it easy you're just going to tell me when to click forward. That's what we're going to do. Sure you do.
Yeah.
That'll work perfectly. All right, so.
Okay, so I just press the bottom button.
There we go. Left and right, left and right. Oh, yeah, come on. Yeah, I'm sorry, I thought you were there. There you go.
Thank you.
And that's left and right. Yeah. Give it a shot. Cecilia.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay. So I'm Cecilia Ganji. I'm the VP of HR for Pi Sigma Epsilon. This is Alyssa. She's my VP of, or my director of recruitment, sorry. Can you sit? Awesome. So we're a national co-ed business fraternity on campus. We're open to all majors. We meet on Tuesday nights from 7:30 to 8:30 in BSA 217, which is right across the street. We're partnered with Zanes, which is our philanthropy, and they bring awareness to children and adults with special needs, and we do a bunch of volunteer events with them throughout the semester. And this is our recruitment video.
I joined PSC because I wanted to build myself personally and professionally and gain a career out of it.
In PSC, I've gained a lot of leadership experience by planning chapter fundraisers and philanthropy events for Zanes.
Transfer student, I wanted to get more involved on campus, so I joined PSC, and through this I've made a lot of meaningful friendships.
With joining PSC, I hope to gain a lot of different connections that I can use in the professional world and build lifelong friendships.
Through one of our social events with our corporate sponsor, Sherwin-Williams, I was able to create a connection with them, which ultimately led to my internship.
So, why you should join PSC? So there's tons of opportunities for leadership. So me personally, when I first joined, I was just a general member. And then last semester, I became a director of recruitment, which is Alyssa's current position. And now I'm the VP of HR, so I've built my way up. We've got tons of volunteer opportunities and social events. So we're not just all business all the time. We do like to do social things. We've got resume and interview workshops. Scholarships are offered every year. We have a scholarship through our chapter, and then there's also national scholarships offered through our headquarters. You can develop networks that allow you to get the job you want and where you want it. We have tons of companies that come in and speak to us at our chapter meetings, and they love to hear from you. They love to network with you. And it's excellent professional development. Our whole thing is growing ourselves as professionals, which is why we put on the workshops that we have. We do like our internship roundtables, so you learn a lot for sure. And this is a QR code if you'd like to sign up for any more information. Follow us on our Instagram. There's also more recruitment information on there. And my contact information if you have any additional questions or just want to reach out. I'm there. So thank you so much for letting me speak to you guys. I hope some of you could be interested. And yeah, thank you.
Any questions for Cece? Thank you, Cece.
Thank you, guys.
And Angie.
Thank you so much.
Et cetera. Okay, so we know that Mini Test 3 opened last Friday. It closes this Tuesday. I've sent you a reminder if you haven't taken it yet. If you haven't done very well, you should go back and do better because you got 5 attempts. Why not? Enhanced Learning Extra Credit, number one, Packback, number one, opened last Friday. They closed this Thursday. Don't forget to do those. Optional extra credits if you want to add up to 3% to your final course grade. I like this story a lot. It had an Ohio connection, and it's an oddball product. Do you guys say washboards, or do you say washboards? Washboard? Washboard. Nobody has a wash? No? All right, so I'll say washboard. Anyhow, America's last washboard factory isn't ready to throw in the towel. The Columbus Washboard Factory, founded before the first electric washing machines put a new spin on laundering in the early 1900s, has dodged extinction for 128 years. Presently, when we talk about product of the four P's of the market mix, product, place, price, promotion, we'll talk about the product life cycle, introduction, growth, maturity, and decline. And we'll say that some products manage to hang on in that decline stage. This is one of those companies. So success in the decline stage of the product life cycle. And obviously, anybody at home have a washboard? Your parents home have a washboard? Grandparents? Anybody at grandparents has a washboard? Sometimes we actually see them used for decoration in the laundry room. People buy them and put them up as a decor. Anyhow, it's obviously a niche market. As America's last washboard maker, the company controls the market, holding a monopoly with a steely grip and so far clean of antitrust scrutiny. Four employees churn out roughly 11,000 washboards a year in the basement of a former G.C. Murphy discount variety store. A popular pail-sized model sells for $27.49. So they are a de facto monopoly, right? Because nobody else is in the business, they're the only one left. They didn't set out to create a monopoly, but everyone left around them. And this is the idea of price in the marketing mix. Even in the decline stage, you can still get a profit if you have a niche market. The market is small, but if we can make enough to keep in business, we really want to keep the business going, says Larry Gerstner, one of the company's four co-founders. So again, niche marketing in the decline stage of the product life cycle. Columbus Washboard sold more than a million washboards a year in its 1940s heyday. That was when wood and corrugated steel boards were used for scrubbing clothing and linens by hand in a wash tub of soap and water. Washing machines in post-war prosperity set off an absolutely going to happen decline. So here's the impact of, quote, technology, a washing machine, on a particular product category, washboards. Today, about 40% of company sales go to bluegrass and folk musicians who use the boards as percussion instruments, go figure. So that's another niche market. Most of Columbus's sales come through Amazon, including by customers who want to hang the washboards on a wall in the laundry room. But Columbus Washboards also has a retail store in downtown Logan, Ohio. Who knows Logan, Ohio, by the way? Anybody know Logan? One person. Have you ever seen the company itself? Have you ever seen them? Okay. On display are custom washboards with names of bands printed on them. One board is made for Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, another Red Dolly Parton's Smoky Mountain Adventures Diner and Show. So that's their distribution strategy, both Amazon and a downtown store. The company donated about 5,000 washboards to troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, along with soap, wash tubs, clotheslines, and clothespins. A binder holds photos from soldiers there and messages saying how clean clothes were a luxury where they were stationed. So they really appreciated that donation. So a little bit of social responsibility from America's last washboard factory. Good for them. While Columbus Washboard appears to hold a monopoly, there are not indications that it used its market prowess to harm consumers or drive out rivals. Monopoly power in its own isn't illegal. The company didn't create its monopoly. It was just created by the washing machine, she says. So there's legal factors in business. And I give you a side note here outside the article. An unlawful monopoly exists when one firm controls the market for a product or service and has obtained that market power not because its product or service is superior to others or the only one out there, but they get the monopoly power by suppressing competition with anti-competitive conduct. Not what this company did. They seem like they're pretty clear. Can't get away from Super Bowl. Sorry, guys, it's a big deal in marketing. So Super Bowl 57 sells out its advertising inventory despite the crypto implosion. Last year, a bunch of crypto bought ads on Super Bowl. I don't know if you remember that or not. Those companies are gone. They're still able to sell out their Super Bowl inventory. Less than a week before the big game, Fox Sports announced Monday morning, yesterday, that it sold all of its in-game Super Bowl 57 inventory. So here's sports event advertising. That's much closer to the game day than the company has anticipated due to an atypical series of events, including the implosion of crypto, one of last year's biggest Super Bowl categories. So the impact of external business factors on their business of selling ads. Sources said the company sold multiple 30-second units above $7 million per 30-second slot. That's a lot of toothpaste being sold. That's a lot of product being sold by last September. But some of those deals had been done several years ago. The majority of 30-second spots sold in the mid to high $6 million range. So here's the ad budget issues. Here's media prices for this special event. Fox had units sold to FTX. That was a crypto company that is still technically around but doesn't really exist anymore because it totally declared bankruptcy and fraud. And that created a few available slots. Last year, the most expensive slot that NBC Universal secured was $7 million for the 30-second spot. In 2020, CBS virtually sold out the big game 11 days before kickoff, selling ads for as much as $5.5 million per 30-second spot, well below Fox's record numbers this year of more than $7 million per 30-second slot. So there's, again, price in the marketing mix. So plan to see if there are any good ads on. We pick up election notes page 70 and page 116 in the textbook, continuing chapter 4, talking about ethics and social responsibility in business and marketing. And this is this is where we left off, talking about the issue of unsafe products. We ended with Fisher-Price still not able to figure out how to make a safe product after all these years. We now hear from one of our video guest lecturers on the topic of ethics in his perspective.
As far as ethics to my business, I feel very strongly that I don't want to put a product out there that's going to cause a customer a problem down the road. If there's an issue with the house that I see that they may not see, I take care of it. I don't paint over it. I fix it right. And with our new homes, for example, you know, there's a lot of dealers that'll just order this so cheapest house they could possibly get. But I found that, you know, you put a couple options in there that the customer would never see when they walk through your model. For example, water shutoffs on the toilets and the faucets versus having to crawl underneath to shut the whole house off. Or center shelves, you know, you open up the cabinets, you don't even think to open up the cabinets when you're walking through a model home. Then you get to move in, you start putting your pots and pans, and there's no center shelves. So, you know, little things like that that we make sure we put in the house because I want 100% referrals. And I don't cover things up. I don't believe in cutting corners. If there's a problem, we fix it right, no matter what the cost is, because I know that person's going to be happy with their house. It's going to be safe and affordable. They're going to come back, and they're going to send referrals back to me. So every decision I make, and I instill that in all my people, that if they're making decisions without me, that we need to do it right the first time, no matter what the cost, and it's going to pay dividends in the long run.
Fantastic from my perspective, which is, of course, why his video guest lecture for me. Ethics starts at the top. You can't fake it out. It goes down to the front line, and you tell them to behave in ethical ways when they deal with your clients and customers and make decisions, even if you're not there. And good ethics is good business. You do things right, you end up with satisfied customers. You screw people over unethically, of course, you don't get the same result. Planned obsolescence, another criticism of marketing. Sometimes I think that we could argue that, indeed, marketers plan to get rid of products earlier than they need to. So this is the idea of products needing replacement before they should because they're made obsolete by new releases. Producers who influence consumers' concepts of acceptable styles. Fashion. Anybody in fashion? You ever heard that you're being blamed for? Well, when I was 100 years ago young and early married, every season my wife needed a new pair of blue jeans. I had blue jeans from the time I was in high school. What do you mean you need a new pair of blue jeans? Well, it's a new season, new style. It's blue jeans! Fashion students. So one criticism of fashion marketers is you're influencing our visions of style such that we're constantly having to update our clothing, yeah? Intentionally holding back attractive functional features, then introducing them later on to make the old model obsolete. What product category leaps to your mind when you hear that description? What is it? Apple cell phones, yep, right. They seem, at least to us consumers, to be taking a planned obsolescence strategy in place. Yeah, I see it's up there. In the case of the Apple iPhone, some quotes, the futurist, why the iPhone reeks of planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence versus design deterioration. And before he died, this was a little more funny. Planned obsolescence-induced insanity, or damn you, Steve Jobs, why must you torment me? So there are obviously people that feel that there is this stuff going on and criticize marketers for it. I think it was interesting to note that we talk about the legal, the outside factor, the external factor of legal in Europe, which oftentimes has a more caring view of the consumer than we do in the States. Legislation was passed in France that requires companies to outline the expected lifespan of a product to consumers. So it gives the consumers information about how long that device is going to last. You might still buy it, but at least you know it's only expected to last 6 months or 2 years or whatever it is. So an international flavor on this concept. Poor service to disadvantaged consumers. Pretty hard to argue that's ethical. Disadvantaged consumers are served poorly when they're forced to shop in smaller stores where they pay more for inferior goods because big corporate retailers won't open up a store in their area. Anybody know what particular retail brand is under criticism for this currently? The Dollar Tree, the dollar stores. There's both sides to the argument to be made. Their argument is, hey, we're not that bad. Sure, that's costing a little more per unit, but these people have no other choices. What are they going to do? And they also say we're beginning to carry, given the criticism, a bit more fresh foods, but people are still paying more than they would pay if it was an Acme in their location, so they're taking a hit for some of these things. Ah, thank you. Criticism of dollar stores, for example. Redlining by national chain stores occurs in disadvantaged neighborhoods. That's basically the same idea. Companies literally go on a map. They say, this is a disadvantaged neighborhood. They draw a circle on the map. We're not doing business inside that circle. That's true of insurers, banks, healthcare facilities, and other companies as well. I think we could agree that perhaps that's not the most ethical, socially responsible behavior for companies to engage in. Poor are targeted for these rapid refunds from these companies that do that. Fees start at $130 for a rapid refund. They average $275. If they were to keep the loan out for a whole year, the APR would be 245%. Last time I checked, 10.6 million low-income families participated in these rapid refund companies. It's a $1.4 billion industry. The Ohio legislatures have been trying to deal with it, but so far have not really done very well on that. But it seems like that's not really the way the world should work for these folks that are struggling anyhow. Cultural pollution. I send out a message, and I mean it for the front row here, and they're going to understand what I'm talking about. They know what the detail is. They get the joke or the information, but the message leaks out because it's on TikTok or it's on Facebook or it's on a TV show, and all you guys see it, and you're going, oh, my goodness, what has he said? Well, you're not in on the – it's not who I wanted it for. You guys ignore it. This sort of thing happens. So mass communication media is imprecise. It reaches outside the target segment. Of course, why should we put up with this? Well, advertising does help to fund all those media sources you engage in, right? Whether it's something streaming, and they have ads, or it's radio or television or magazines or newspapers or websites. So it does seem like we got to put up with advertising, but sometimes it reaches the wrong audience. Now, we do say, if we're trying to defend ourselves, that consumers can opt for technologies or media that eliminate or reduce ads. So your website or your web browser might have an option there.
We all know.
Also, there is, here? Apps. If you want to block kids from seeing certain sites, maybe you can put that on your browser, perhaps. So there are ways to deal with this technologically. This is an example coming up of how people can get really upset when the message intended for one group gets to other people. They get upset.
We all know sex sells. It's used in commercials, in movies, in TV. But should sex be used to sell stuff to teenagers? New provocative ads for the acne cream Clearasil have parents really upset, including Mike Galanos. I'm a parent. I'm a little upset myself here too. This is tonight's Get to the Point segment, and boy, woo.
Let's face it, we work with some pretty open-minded people. Some of the words they used, appalling, disgusting, give you the creeps. We're talking about Clearasil here to help with teens with acne for years now. Well, they've got this May Cause Confidence campaign, a couple of racy ones. One of them here, we basically have a 16-year-old hitting on his friend's mom. Let's check it out.
Hi, guys.
Hey, I'm going to get my stuff. So, Miss Kelly, how are things? Everything good?
Yeah, thanks.
Must be lonely now that Mr. K left. I'm really good company.
Clearasil Ultra Treatment Cream.
All right, there you have it. I just don't get this. In this day and age when you've got teachers, we've done the stories, jumping in the sack with their students.
Absolutely.
Mary Kay Letourneau, we're bringing this. All right, joining me now from Washington to talk about this, Melissa Henson. She's with the Parents Television Council. She wants the ads off the air. We're going to get to her in a minute. Also from New York, Debbie Wolf, the co-founder of People Against Censorship. All right, Debbie. Like I said, I told you, we just mentioned some of the reactions. Mine is, it's disgusting. How are you supporting this ad?
It's not so much the ad that I'm supporting as the right to air it and being against people looking to pull things off the air. Our country is full of people with very different moral compasses, and for one group or even two groups to say you should listen to my moral compass instead of everybody else's concerns me. I thought the ads were funny. I thought they were over the top, and if you look at all three of them, I really don't see how you can't get the humor.
Okay. But when you mention censorship like that, personally, I think an ad is worse than a show because the ad is like an ambush. I don't know it's coming. All of a sudden, 30 seconds later, before I can even grab the remote and change the dial, this has happened. Now I have to have a talk with my 12-year-old. What do you think of that?
I don't see how you can hold advertisers to a higher moral standard than you can to pop culture in general. When you have people looking at Britney Spears, looking at Paris Hilton, looking at everything that's on television, why is Clearasil held to a higher standard? Because they made a joke that you find offensive. It's funny. Do you really think Clearasil is advocating young boys to hit on their friends' mothers? That's just silly.
Granted, there is a humor in there, but what does my 15-year-old understand that? Let's show the next one. This one basically deals with a 16-year-old sex pot. Let's check this one out.
Here's her first tooth. Isn't she cute?
Yeah.
Oh, and here she is, naked in the bath.
You should see me now.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right, who are the players here? Let's stay with you, Debbie, on this one real quick. Mom's a powerless buffoon. You got horny, awkward teen in the middle, and the girl's the sex bot. Do we really need to sex up our teens any more than they already are?
I don't know. I don't know where we got 16-year-olds, first of all. I don't see.
She doesn't look much older than that, but go ahead. Make your point.
I'm not sure why we got, how we know that the boy is horny either. But you asked where the parents come in on this, or how does my daughter respond to this? How do my children respond to it? The response is because you as a parent are there, and you're watching this commercial, and you have an opportunity to explain to your children how they should react. If you look on the message boards that are attacking this ad, there are also people saying, my daughter, my son looked at that and thought that was awful. That's because they educated their children to the moral code that they are seeking. And that's how you deal with ads like this.
Well, I shouldn't be forced by Clearasil or anybody else to have this conversation when my son or daughter isn't ready. Let's get Melissa Henson in on this, again, with the Parents Television Council. Am I being overly sensitive or a prude on this one, Melissa?
No, I don't think you're being overly sensitive at all. I'm disturbed that this is part of a larger pattern of using sex. And, of course, we know that they've used sex to sell products for decades, generations. But this is, I think, part of a trend of using very overtly sexual imagery and messaging to target very young consumers. It's not just this. It's, you know, the Carl's Jr. hamburger ads advertising flat buns where they're, you know, teenage boys singing about their teachers' posterior. And I think it's just all over the top, unnecessary, and I'm very disturbed by the fact that Clearasil's creative team can't think of a better way to promote confidence in young girls.
We wanted to get a representative from Clearasil. Yeah. Here's their statement. I want to let everybody know. It says, our objective is to inform and entertain, not to offend. We have found that Clearasil consumers see this ad as we intended, a humorous and unrealistic presentation of an awkward family event. I don't know many awkward family events like that, but I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. This has been a good one. We appreciate it. Debbie Wolf with People Against Censorship and Melissa Henson
Thank
with
you.
The Parents Television Council. Appreciate your time from both of you. And now we want to know what you think of this one. Do you think these ads are raunchy? Do you agree with me and think these are over the top, irresponsible at best? Or, hey, am I the prude here? Let us know. Email us, cnn.com/primenews. Click on the link. Email us, video mail us for that matter. Hey, they put me on TV. They might put you on as well.
So there we go. So this sort of advertising exists. How many of you guys feel, you know, when I really think about it, that is over the top. It's just not necessary. 15% of the class. How many people think beyond that it's just unethical to do that? Okay. How many people found it just humorous or funny? Okay. An important thing we just see right here is there are different segments of the population. Different people have, if you will, different moral compasses, different views of the world, different views about what's right and wrong in life, in advertising. Now we come up with the question, what should happen? So, you know, this sort of advertising should be banned, frankly. Anybody think it should just be banned? It's that bad. Another approach you could argue is, what about it being censored? What about there sort of being a board that checks this stuff and censors out ads that are inappropriate? Couple? Okay. Couple folks? Yeah. I mean, why is that necessary? Let's just censor it out. Or should consumer response be the main influence? If consumers don't like this stuff, they should stop buying the product, complain on social media, and presumably the market will pay attention. Okay? I'll cheat and say that's my view of what should happen because I'm into marketing and consumers. If the audience does not like what's going on, they will react. They will stop buying your product, and you'll stop doing whatever's upsetting them. But there are other perspectives out there that are legit as well. Clearasil says, look, our objective is to inform and entertain. We're not here to offend our audience. That would be stupid. That's not what we're doing. And we found that our front row, our consumers, our audience, sees this ad as we intend it to be, a humorous and unrealistic presentation of an awkward family event. But it bleeds over to everybody else, and others get people get upset. We see sex selling in a variety of different ways. I don't know if you've ever heard of Calvin Klein's ads, perhaps. Yes, I know you have. There are over 500,000 photos on Instagram tagged hashtag MyCalvins. Most are selfies of lean 20-somethings in their beds and bathroom mirrors, proudly united by cotton underwear bearing the name Calvin Klein. These are unpaid, authentic posts that endorse the brand. They're an extremely powerful way to interact with young people, far more effective than the more obviously paid-for influencer posts or a printed ad. Should we ban those? Should those be censored? Or they're honest, authentic people posting? This is an example of somebody who's really unhappy with an ad that went up in Manhattan. See if this works.
Hi, I'm Heidi Zak, CEO and co-founder of Third Love. But more than that, I'm a strong and powerful woman and proud of it. I believe that women can do anything without limitation and that we aren't defined by our underwear. I'm personally offended by the Calvin Klein billboard ad in New York City that highlights a dated gender stereotype, that men are the breadwinners while women are sex objects. Women not only deserve respect, we demand it. The women of New York and women everywhere join me in saying we are no longer accepting this antiquated stereotype, and instead are creating our own gender definitions, that a woman can be anything she wants to be.
I'm just wondering if you take a look at that billboard there, if you could give us your thoughts and reaction.
It's terrible, and it's offensive. I'm not happy about it, and I won't give Calvin Klein my money.
And bada bink, bada boom. You are offended by the ad that says I seduce in my Calvin Kleins versus I make money in my Calvin Kleins, although I'm pretty sure they wouldn't be happy with a woman who thinks that I make money in my Calvin Kleins either. Not the point. Then you should be offended. Don't buy the thing. And if you don't buy the thing, that's as it should be. If consumers don't agree, then they shouldn't buy the brand's products. If they don't buy the brand's products, the brand will stop doing whatever the thing is they're doing. Yeah? You may have a different view. That's the view I'm promoting here. All right? And it goes on and on, right? This next one is truly upsetting if you're sensitive. So at home, if you have young children sitting here in raptly watching my marketing lecture, and they might be under 13 and easily influenced by sexy marketing stuff, don't have them view this. If you yourself... if you yourself are easily offended, look down for this next slide. Here we go. This is a true ad some people will find upsetting. This is iFlash in my Calvin Klein's. Frank Donio says, you've crossed a line. JC Danner says, this is tasteless. Uber Cool says, another exponent of the hashtag Vorgasm Uber trend. So Peter Davis, editor-at-large at Paper Magazine, says, look, a peek-up actress Clara Kristen skirt to glimpse her C-key panties is not pity kitty porn. It's sexy, and we've heard that sex sells. And Clara isn't 15 years old. No one knows how to sell underwear and fragrances and clothing by promoting scandalous sex better than Calvin Klein. Every erotically charged fashion ad post-Calvin Klein's golden era in the 70s and 80s owes everything to that brand, from Tom Ford and his infamous steamy and near-naked Gucci campaigns to Dolce & Gabbana's oiled-up men in Speedos. Sex sells products. Not everyone likes it. Anybody here? This guy. You guys know this guy? Who is it? That's not Calvin Klein. Justin Bieber. I knew. I was just kidding with you. The hashtag MyCalvin's campaign has led to significant growth on Calvin's social platforms since the, admittedly a bit old, but it still makes the point about sex selling, February 2014 launch. It's bulked its Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter followings by 2.2 million, 1.8 million, and 1 million people, respectively. People seem to like it. Facebook currently has, 1221, when I last looked, 13.7 million Calvin followers. Let's see what the number is today. Can't be less, can it? 13.9 million people follow this on Facebook, okay? Where was I? Twitter, 17.5 million, 3.7 million, something's wrong there on Twitter, I repeat it. It reached global audiences, surpassing 469 million fans, yielding 23.4 million fan interactions. In July 2014, the brand expanded its advertising to Tinder. As Chief Marketing Officer Melissa Goldie explained, the platform is authentic and true to how this consumer communicates. As a direct result of the Bieber campaign, Calvin Klein's benefited from 3.6 million additional followers across its social channels. We could say, stop doing it if people don't like it. People don't seem to mind it. Shocker, sex sells. In 2021, while the fashion industry in general, and Calvin Klein in particular, usually markets by being outrageous, P.G. Lang by Calvin Klein's opts for relatable. In one especially comical video, Travis Bennett promotes his favorite CK jeans without said jeans on. It's an oddball approach. We've seen Calvin Klein ads push many boundaries, but never quite like this. Quote, Dave called me and had this idea. We bounced it back and forth, Bennett says. P.G. Lang, to me, is creating with no boundaries, as cliche as it might sound. Let's see if this works for us. It's not sexy, but it's pushing boundaries.
Yo, it's good.
Yeah, I'm just finishing up right now. I can't believe that Calvin really gave me this, man. I feel really honored. This is crazy. It's like a big achievement. Oh, how's it look? It could look better considering how much they pay me for it, but I mean, dude, I'm gonna take home the money, and what they gonna do, beat me up? I could have given a little more time and effort, but I mean, you know, I'm a little last minute with everything, so. Did I blow it? No, I didn't blow it.
That's a billboard.
No, I mean, I just,
those
I
are
put a lot of
on the billboard.
I think when you see it, you'll notice that it's a lot of taco touch on there.
He's not wearing any pants.
A shout out on here? Okay, wait. I should know this. What's your last name again? Okay. Getting mad at me isn't going to help this. So, what is your last name?
All right. So, a bit of humor rather than outright sexiness, pushing the limit of what's how to get attention. Social responsibility in marketing would be an ethical approach to doing marketing. Yes, we'd agree to that. It's an important thing to think about. And we talk about things like sustainability. At PepsiCo, we believe there's an opportunity to change how the world produces, distributes, consumes, and disposes of foods and beverages. In order to tackle the shared challenges we face, we aim to use our scale, reach, and expertise to help build a more sustainable food system, one that can meet human needs for nutrition and enjoyment and continue to drive economic and social development without exceeding the natural boundaries of the planet. That sounds like a good approach, as well as being good for our business. Working to realize this purpose is also the right thing to do. Ethical, good marketing can be good for business. Recycling program from Pepsi. The U.S. is recycling less than half its bottles and cans. PepsiCo believes that bigger change starts with one bottle, one person, one action. You wouldn't mow just half your lawn, only recycling half your products, or clip half your dog. Why not give 100% to recycling as well? Backing this up with your commercial.
You wouldn't do something halfway, would you? In the U.S., we're recycling less than 50% of our bottles and cans. Join PepsiCo in the recycling of every last bottle and can.
Okay, so they are putting their money behind their concept with an ad campaign of socially responsible marketing. So how does management in general react to this need to be ethical? Well, one approach is to make sure that your entire corporate culture has an ethical aura to it. Right? So, for example, Aveda. Says, look, our mission and our heritage, our mission at Aveda is to care for the world we live in, from the products we make to the ways in which we give back to society. At Aveda, we strive to set an example for environmental leadership and responsibility, not just in the world of beauty, but around the world. Pretty broad, positive mission that infuses their corporate culture. Or create codes of ethics for your people or your business partners. This is how we expect you to act if you interact with us. Kraft Heinz conducts business in an ethical manner, guiding by the enduring principles of our founders and an unwavering commitment to integrity. And here is our code of conduct, how we expect you to behave. Here's a way to report any concerns. Here's guidance for us if you're a supplier of ours. Behavior of top management. Ethics starts at the top. If the top leaders are cheating, goofy, wasting money, whatever, that's going to filter down. You can't turn to the front line and say, you be ethical, don't worry about what I'm doing. That's not right. As I just said, Kraft has a place where you can report concerns, but have an ombudsman for ethics, where your employees can report anonymously concerns. Corporate Ombudsman Office here at American Red Cross, independent, confidential, neutral, informal. So if you have a concern, go to the ombudsman and state your concern and know that it'll be taken care of. How many people know we have a Kent State ombuds? Anybody know that? Student ombuds? One person does, two people do. So when you have concerns, I'm treating you unfairly, you can go to the ombuds and present your case and say, Dr. Marx is an unfair person. He doesn't like people who are whatever I am. Or he doesn't, whatever the detail is. I don't want to get myself in trouble by joking about something. His jokes are terrible and he shows sex in marketing. I want to complain. So you can take your complaint to the student ombudsman here. So a response to the need to be ethical is to manage the ethical environment of your firm and its employees. We said earlier, and I forget if it's going to come up again in the introduction to this, a comment is, I can't make my employees be ethical or something like that. What I say is, and I forget if I say it again coming up, I can't control what you think, okay? I can't control your thoughts. But I can darn well control how you behave in my enterprise, what you do, what rules you follow. So you may have unethical thoughts, but you do not implement those in my business. So I can control the ethicalness of my business, of my people. One more view from a video guest lecturer.
Very important to us. If you don't have the ethics and abide by those, it's hard for me, number one, to trust you and hire you. That's first and foremost. It's all about trust. So, we have a lot of belief in our people. We believe in them, unless they prove us wrong. Just like, I have children, like I mentioned, similar type situation. But, we also believe we don't want to be deceptive in our pricing or advertising. We want to say, here's what we're doing and why, and be very upfront and honest. We don't want people coming back, a year later or even 6 months later, saying, hey, this isn't what you promised me. Because you get into a lot of issues that way. I personally, coming from the telecommunications industry, saw a lot of the questionable ethical practices. Good example, one of the larger firms, MCI. They had a great company. We were competing head-to-head, and their growth rates were unbelievable, and we were getting bashed in the marketplace because of that at the time. We find out later, some of the things they were doing, the numbers were inflated quite a bit, and that whole house of cards came tumbling down. That could happen anywhere. I think Sarbanes-Oxley, even though I'm not an accountant, nor do I want to be, I think that's helped out, accountability. Processes and following that and the audits that go with that. So it's defined a lot of things that weren't there before. So that's helped out, but I'm going to be honest. Ethics starts at the top and works its way down. If you're CEO, a vice president, it works its way down. If they're not ethical, that's the type of people they're going to hire. If they're ethical and they abide by standards and they adhere to those standards, I think that's where it starts, right there.
Any accounting types here that knows or has heard of Sarbanes-Oxley? Is that something you've heard about before here at all? So my understanding, and I'm not an accountant, nor do I want to be an accountant, but Sarbanes-Oxley is a law that was brought about because of all the unethical behavior of a lot of CEO types who would say, I guess that's what the accounting folks did or the financial people did. I don't know what they did, so sorry it was all inflated. Sorry it was all wrong. And the law came back and said, wait a minute, on these audits where you have to make statements about the trueness of your financial records, you signed the document and you're responsible for it, at least in public firms. I don't know if it works that way in a private company. They're on a different thing. But in public firms, you, CEO, are signing it. You can't just say, oh, it was that guy over there, the accountant, that did it wrong. So that's one view of ethics. Here's, when he comes up, Fred Hunt's talking about his view of ethics over at Sherwin-Williams, and he has some pretty strong opinions on it.
Now, the question of ethics in business today. I have a very long military background as well as many years in industry. And it's been my experience that when it comes to speaking about ethics, it all starts at the top. It really does. In the case of Sherwin-Williams, we have an excellent executive staff who absolutely live by the ethics that you would expect and exceed that. Just an exemplary group of folks and push that those thoughts through every corner of the organization. I've yet to meet anyone in a position of decision making in this organization that made a decision that I felt at all uncomfortable with, nor would they even broach it. I mean, it just is a phenomenal place to be.
And so,
now, the question of ethics in business today.
All right, there's the verbiage. I forget if I asked, has anybody ever worked in your organization where the people around you are not behaving ethically? Have you had that misfortune? Did that make you feel good every day about going to work and working with these people? I see a lot of heads saying no. One guy's going, well, yeah, I was one of the unethical people. So you go to work, you can't trust the people, you can't trust your bosses, you don't know how they're going to screw you over. It's not a good situation as opposed to what Fred says here. I've never worked with anybody here who's given me any reason to concern, to not trust them. It's a phenomenal place to work. Good ethics, good for business. So good ethics is good business. Patagonia was doing sustainable before most companies even knew what sustainable was. And now the brand is benefiting in interesting ways. Patagonia, I say lately, but has been urging its outdoorsy customers to buy less and question whether they really need that several hundred dollar new parka, even from Patagonia. The messaging has been suggesting they should just repair that one and keep it instead of buying a new $700 parka to replace it. The result, Patagonia's fans and customers are both joining the brand's sustainability cause and buying more new parkas from Patagonia. Sales increased almost one-third to $543 million, whatever last year was, which included about 9 months of the Buy Less marketing campaign. Patagonia founder and owner Yves Chouinard says, "I know it sounds crazy, but every time I've made a decision that's best for the planet, I've made money. Our customers know that, and they want to be part of that environmental commitment." So his good ethics has been good for his business. And if you may have heard, we mentioned it earlier in the course, in September 2022, Yvonne and his wife and children transferred their ownership of Patagonia, valued at about $3 billion, to a specially designed trust and a nonprofit organization. They were created to preserve the company's independence and ensure that all of the profits, some $100 million a year, are used to combat climate change and to protect undeveloped land around the globe. That is true commitment to social responsibility and to sustainability as a corporate business model. A little unusual. We aren't going to see a lot of companies do that, but still, that's the extreme. Accenture Strategies Global Consumer Pulse Research revealed that consumers across all generations do care about what retailers say and how they act. Consumers under 30, those belonging to Gen Z and millennial generations, feel a strong affiliation to retailers that subscribe to a larger purpose, according to their study. More than 6 in 10 younger consumers closely consider a company's ethical values and authenticity before buying their products. It's a brand's responsibility to discover the topics that their target audience cares about. Retailers have always had to understand their consumers. By the way, our next chapter, Understanding the Consumer, their buying habits, demographics, behavioral patterns. This understanding of what's important to them in terms of social responsibility is just another layer of understanding. For instance, Accenture's research found that companies that reduce plastics are more appealing to the baby boomer generation of 55 to 74-year-olds. Millennials and Gen Z felt stronger about social mobility, immigration, and poverty. So while you're acting ethical, are there special areas that you should focus on, given your target audience? What's really important to them? And don't behave unethical in the other areas. So good ethics is good business for shareholders. They know that your reports are honest, your numbers are true, you aren't lying about your market share. For employees, because they feel comfortable with working at your organization. For your business partners, who likewise know what you say is true and honest and you're not cheating them. Clearly for your customers and your clients, and for society at large, to the extent that as a business, you celebrate and believe in and promote good ethics, social responsibility, and sustainability, it helps society at large to adapt those attitudes. In my organization, and most of your professional organizations, professional lives, there's going to be some organization that represents you. Mine's the American Marketing Association. They have a statement on ethics. The American Marketing Association commits itself to promoting the highest standard of professional ethical norms and values for its members, practitioners, academics, and students. The CEO writes, as of the Black Lives Movement Matter summer and these other issues that have been occurring, he writes, "It's not a time for passivity. Positive intentions, altruistic motives, and empathetic sentiments are not enough. The American Marketing Association is confronting the insidious rot of racism in our society head on. We can do more, be better, and be held accountable for turning tomorrow's hope into today's action. A change management expert once taught him that change only occurs when there's committed leadership and universal dissatisfaction with the current state. Effective communication and adoption of dissatisfaction often begins with dramatic declarations that we are universally fed up with the status quo. Everyone in the marketing community deserves voice and influence with respect to this institution. Help us. We expect to hear the uncomfortable, but all of us have had it with the slow progress of racial equality equity and equality. The urgent and acute need to meet this moment of such hurtful racism and generational damage is our number one priority. Black Lives Matter. Pretty serious statement from the head of AMA. So, as ethical marketers, we must do no harm, foster trust in the marketing system, embrace ethical values of honesty, responsibility, fairness, respect, transparency, citizenship. We expect AMA members to be courageous and proactive in leading and or aiding their organizations in the fulfillment of all these things I just said. So AMA, marketing, my parent organization, is serious about it. And hopefully whatever organization you guys have that represent your professions are equally serious about ethics, social responsibility. All right? So that is the topic of ethical and social responsibility in marketing. I mentioned a few times that we view marketing as the discovery and satisfaction of consumer needs, wants, and desires out of profit through an integrated effort of the firm. Seems like we ought to spend a little time understanding more about consumers. I need all you guys to hide. Why are you showing up? Hide. Disappear. Go away. What's happening? Excuse me one second while I see if I can... Yes? Okay. So understanding consumer behavior. This is the B2C side of the house. We also have the B2B side organizations. So we're here focused on the ultimate consumer, you guys by and large. All right? Lecture notes, page 76, chapter 5 of the textbook. So once more, we're back to our framework for strategic marketing management. We're thinking we're still pretty high above the four P's of marketing. We're assessing marketing opportunities, market opportunities. And we are thinking about the B2C world just now, understanding the consumer that helps guide the rest of the process.
From the nonprofit standpoint, marketing is a little bit different. For what I do, marketing is, number one, learning the motivation of my donor. And quite honestly, I don't think that you can market a product or a service without understanding and learning the motivation of your donor. And I think that that's above the price, promotion, place, maybe not product, but certainly understanding why that person would be interested in giving a donation or purchasing your car as opposed to one from General Motors. You have to understand the motivation, what gets people to do what they are going to do. And to me, it is understanding their motivation and then marketing what I do to that motivation.
And we talked one time about what would motivate somebody to donate to a hospital. And it's not all the same. We've got financial reasons. We've got social prestige reasons. We've got giving back reasons. We have a whole bunch of reasons that someone might donate. And we recognized when we talked about it that you have to understand that motivation in order to create the right campaign for them. And that's true in other brand areas as well. So let's think about understanding the consumer. So this next piece, I assume it's in the right place, is Jeffrey Gannett from Macy's. Competition rears its ugly head. Talking about his view of the importance of understanding that consumer.
Jeff, you started working at Macy's as a trainee 35 years ago, and now you're the CEO. You know, people dream about being the boss in charge of this iconic store. What's the key to your success?
You know, I'm a good listener, and I'm an avid learner. So just being a constant, perpetual learner and exposing myself to the brand the way the customer does is one of the secrets to my success. Wherever I'm going, my head is up. I'm looking at pop culture. What can I learn? What is the consumer digesting? What website should I be going to? I have a reverse mentor that is helping me learn about what the Gen Z customer is doing.
I do hear that you're very curious and that you ask lots of questions. Is there one question that you just keep asking over and over again everywhere you go?
What does the customer think? What's the customer reaction? She'll tell you. When I walk a store, I go to those associates, and you just ask them, what is the customer saying, and they will tell you. And you learn so much behind the strategy, where it came apart, where you didn't execute it right, what the need is. And our entire team of executives really are more focused on that frontline colleague than ever. You know, the customer is king on this, and we've got that frontline colleague that understands the customer better than any of us. So when she tells us what she needs and what she wants, those are marching orders. So when I bring that back to the store, I plug it in, and the organization responds.
Described as a pragmatic innovator. What does that mean?
You know, I think what's important about innovation is it's not a shiny penny. You've got to find something that actually can be bolted into the business that is serving the strategy that you've decided on. And ultimately, is it additive to the customer experience? So that's probably, you know, when you think about innovation and practicality, I want to make sure at the end of the day, does the customer value this? Is it going to drive shareholder value? Is it the right investment for us to make?
So whether we're talking about a donation environment for a not-for-profit organization or a retail store or any brand, we've got to understand that consumer. What are their needs? What are their motives? How can we provide them with something of value that will satisfy them? And oftentimes it's the frontline employee who interacts with that consumer who gets some of those insights in the aggregate to inform the organization. So what does the consumer need and want and value? What motivates them to look at our brand versus some other brand? We have to understand what we broadly call here consumer behavior. And today, we certainly need to understand them as we still have the remnants of COVID-related changes that still are sticking around. The way we're going to do this is through a fairly elaborate model of consumer behavior, which you have in your notes. You see that I've adapted this from a set of authors, Engel, Colton, Blackwell. And first of all, at the top, we have five sets of variables that are going to help us to understand consumers. One is a set of input variables, stimuli that get the consumer going. These are marketer-dominated stimuli like ads and so forth. How the consumer processes that information, how they understand the information, we'll come to see. Consumers don't always get the information exactly as you put it out. A set of external influences that go beyond the consumer, culture, subculture, social class, reference, family. A set of decision process variables that brings together all of these other factors and helps it to come to make a decision, the decision process. So input variables, information processing variables, decision process variables, the decision process itself, and external influences. And what we just were mumbling about here was one of those things, motivation. But let's start with the broader idea of the decision process itself. We want to understand how consumers come to buy our products. So first of all, we would argue people may do things that are sometimes silly or for novelty, but they're doing something to fulfill a need. Even when they buy something impulsively, it's because they want a candy bar. They didn't plan for it. Or if you're buying a house or a car or a new suit, you have some need that you want to fulfill. What is the consumer's need in the case of your particular product, brand, service? Typically, they search for value. Now, when it's an impulse purchase, the search is instantaneous. I want a candy bar. Boom, I bought a candy bar. But if it's a new car, they may not just go, boom, I'll buy that one. They look around a little bit, what's out there. So they're seeking value. Given the choices that are out there, then, they evaluate those alternatives. They assess the value of each of the potential cars, blouses, sports coats, vacation packages, potential donation sites that are out there. Which one's going to satisfy me the most? I'm evaluating the value that they would bring to me. I then make a choice. So based on my understanding, I buy value. And finally, I use the thing, or get the feelings from donating or whatever it might be. But I use the thing. So we talk about the outcomes. What value did I get out of consuming the service of the product? Did it satisfy my problem? Did it fix things up for me or not? So that's the overview of this whole thing. Let's start with the idea of problem recognition. And what we're seeing here is that problem recognition can be internally generated or come from external factors, for example, through our memory. But a problem recognition is a perception. That's a difference between the actual situation and the desired or ideal situation. How many people today missed lunch? Missed lunch. And here we are, we're talking, and I'm blathering on, and you're looking at the clock, and it's getting to be 4:30, 4:45, and you're getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. Do I need to remind you that you missed lunch for you to be getting hungry? Do I need to tell you that you missed lunch? Do I need to show you an ad for food? No, you know you missed lunch. You're getting hungry. An internally, totally internal motivating force. Also, I could show you a delightful ad for some really tasty food. That might be an external factor. And maybe if you aren't really hungry right now, you're thinking, boy, that looks good. So we have a perception that there's a difference between the actual state, boy, I wish I had eaten, and the desired state I didn't eat, and the actual state I wish I had. Influenced by consumers' internal needs and motives, you have a need to look more attractive. You're going to buy a new sports coat. To be less hungry. To be a member of your community, you're going to donate. And fortunately for us in marketing, it's also influenced by firms, marketers, that can activate problem recognition by marketing communications that highlight such things as the limitations of your current products. You currently have this. It's got some problems. Or, if you like, limitation of competitive products. This is a true story, which at least amuses me. I showed this ad for a number of cycles, a number of classes. And finally, one day, I actually looked to see what I was talking about. Print from any room or age in the house. Live wirelessly. Print wirelessly. And I realized, wait a minute. How many of you guys at home, parents at home, maybe have a computer that's hooked to a PC, and it only works when the PC is on? Anybody have that still today? Okay. I had that for a long time. Anytime the wife or the kid wanted to do something from the laptop, I had to go upstairs, turn on the PC, turn on the printer. Finally, one day I woke up and said, wait a minute, that is me. There was an ad that literally caused me to go buy an HP printer that's wireless. That was a problem. I now recognized it. There was a cure. I went and bought a PC. So literally, the marketing communication reminded me that there was a solution there. So once we recognize we have a problem, we might search for a solution. Anybody ever run out of toothpaste? Run out of toothpaste? That ever happened? Yeah? So when you run out of toothpaste, you go to buy a new toothpaste, right? How do you know what to buy? What do you do? Well, I'm going to go pick on somebody because nobody's going to raise their hand for that question. I saw you raise your hand. You've run out of toothpaste. What do you do? How do you know which one to buy? Oh, you've never run out of toothpaste in your life. You go with the brand that you, how many of us in general just go with the brand for many things, the brand we bought? So where is that information coming from? Memory. I remember the brand. Okay, that's not very stunning. So sometimes the search is pretty darn simple. We do an internal search of memory, and we ask ourselves, what did we buy last time? And that's the one we buy again. It's not a big deal. It's not very elaborate. Sometimes you remember the brand name. Have you ever had a situation where you just can't quite remember the brand name, but if you see the package, you'll know it's that one in the store? It's that one in that color scheme or whatever, right? In fact, we see where we have generic brands like at CVS or Drug Mart, sometimes their brand looks a lot like the color scheme on our brand. A little hope if you're really running around just grabbing something, maybe you'll try theirs and it'll be okay. Have you ever had a situation where you aren't sure of either of those things, but you know which part of the store it's in? I hate shopping in a new grocery store because half the time I know what to buy because it's over there in that aisle. So sometimes we just recall the aisle it's in, the color of the packaging, the brand name. Pretty simple stuff, but it's important for marketers to know it happens that way. Sometimes we don't really have enough information in memory, so we actually engage in external search. So maybe, thank goodness, as marketers, our consumers look to find a solution to their problem, search for a solution to marketer-dominated sources. They talk to salespeople. Thank goodness that people talk to you and ask you for your opinion on the latest fashion or what looks good on them or what's coming up next. Got to be honest, of course, ethical, honest. And so thank goodness that that's one place that they look for information. So we train our salespeople to treat the customer right. or on our website, or in ads, things that we dominate, that we run. Of course, they also check personal sources of information. They check with relatives. They check with friends to see what sorts of solutions they might have. So in the women's department at Nordstrom, do a lot of your shoppers come in with their friends when they shop, or there are a lot of single shoppers? Or is it about half and half? Half the audience comes in with a friend who also helps share their opinion on what they ought to look at, what they look in, what they should buy. Yeah? We have to be aware of the personal sources that our consumers might talk about. And sometimes people go to public sources like Consumer Reports, like government agencies, to look for reviews of our products. What do your consumers tend to focus on if they have to go beyond what they just know? My Dell laptop, 2 years old, 1 year out of warranty, just turned into a brick today, this morning. I'm sad. I'm going to send it back to them for a small fee because it's out of warranty. And we'll see what they tell me it takes to replace it. When I bought that laptop, man, I was up on laptop stuff. I knew what was current. I knew the graphics card, and I knew the processor, and I knew the memory. I knew what was what. If I have to buy a new one in a month, because this one is too expensive to repair, I probably must just go back to memory and say, I'll buy the same one I bought last time. A whole new generation has come out. What am I going to do? I'm going to start looking to see among the brands that are out there, what's the price structure, what's the graphics card, what's the memory, et cetera. I'm going to do a new search for new information. Shane Dutka, who's an affiliate marketer and one of our video guest lecturers, talks to us that as an affiliate marketer, he can provide information about possible solutions to help serve the consumer's problem. And then when they buy the solution that he is talking about, he earns a bit of money.
As an affiliate marketer, we add value in the process of buying something via education. What happens is if people want to buy something, they have a problem. Man, my back really hurts, you know, like best way to get rid of back pain. What happens is they'll Google that, they'll find affiliates who will then educate them on which direction they need to go in. As an affiliate, I would present a blog post or some kind of piece of content to educate that person about the three solutions to their back pain, and each one of them might have an affiliate link, which to go to a product, maybe a back brace, and that's how I would make money and basically be a part of that sales cycle.
So he is helping consumers to solve their problem by providing them with information for their search on various alternatives.
As an affiliate,
so we know we have a problem. We've done our search. We've come up with some alternatives. How will we decide which of the possible alternatives out there to choose? Well, we argue that you bring to bear a set of evaluative criteria, is our fancy word. These are the factors that, in your mind, the consumer, represent the brand's characteristics. And those are the things that you use to compare and evaluate the possible brand choices. I have to know what you consider to be important in this purchase. Is it price? Is it availability? Is it taste? Is it style? Is it social prestige? What is it as you go to evaluate these things that you consider important? For fashion, for my wife, we know it's the status and stylishness of a Nordstrom or a Macy's. Close. We know for me, it's the good enough quality and price of a Kohl's. We both are shopping for clothes, but we have different evaluative criteria. These evaluative criteria help us to form beliefs about the brands that are out there. And from those beliefs, we form positive or negative, favorable or unfavorable attitudes as part of this decision process. Marketers try to understand and influence these evaluative criteria to help you form beliefs and attitudes that are favorable to our brand. This is a classic one from a while ago, and it's very specific. You can see that Windows is trying to influence the consumer based on what they understand the evaluative criteria for consumers to be for this sort of device.
Oh no, here we go again. Oh dear, I need a little help here.
I'm sorry, I don't have a USB port. Oh snap. You have a real keyboard too? This isn't going to end well for me, is it? Nope, definitely not ending well. Do you still think I'm pretty?
So what are the evaluative criteria that we think consumers are going to use to judge a tablet? Look at all these things that we have, including a lower price, that they don't have over there. We might influence a bunch of people who are looking at different choices out there, if our judgment of the value criteria is correct, to buy our brand. We have those things. In the COVID-19 era, as social distancing and protective measures became the new norm, shopping from home was seen as safe and convenient, right? These factors became new to us as marketers, evaluative criteria for a lot of purchase decisions. For many marketers, this meant rethinking how to connect with their consumers. Clearly, a stronger emphasis on e-commerce and digital channels became crucial in this pandemic time, including consideration of the role of direct-to-consumer e-commerce channels. We've already mentioned that the pandemic moved all of these factors many years forward for retailers as they had to deal with this new situation, because this was the consumer's new evaluative criteria. You didn't have it, they weren't shopping from you. So consumers use their evaluative criteria to compare the alternatives in what we call their consideration set, which is also called their evoke set. So consumers' information search should result in a group of brands out there, assuming it's not an impulse purchase. I could buy the Dell, I could buy the IBM. Does IBM still make it? They don't. I could buy various brands out there. Brands that a consumer actually considers buying before making a purchase decision, or knows the evoke set or the consideration set, these are the most preferred alternatives. So out of all those brands, you only know some of them. You don't know others. What's the chance of you buying a brand you don't know? Zero. So oftentimes we stress the importance to marketers, make sure people are aware of your brand, that they know about your brand, because people don't buy brands they aren't aware of. Out of the known brands, though, we have some brands that we know are unacceptable. I'm just not buying from blank. People don't know anything about the brands, or they don't know that the brand exists?
Both.
How do you buy something that you don't know exists?
Not through the brand. It's like, so I've seen this thing on TikTok where people will go buy third-party Alibaba like products and then resell them on Amazon and then make money on the arbitrage. And so, but because people are online looking for a flashlight, it'll just come up with the top result. Click add to cart, and then you, because it's just the top result, people won't know what the brand of what they're buying is.
But they bought on the recommendation. So the information they have is this person is recommending this brand. Let's pick up with it because we've just lost the audience. It's 5:00. But I like this concept. Let's pick it up with the next time. Remember to pick up here. Cool. Thank you. See you next time.